The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Okay, good morning. This is, I think on the schedule, this is titled Disengaging from the Disengagement. Where is Israel headed? Where are we now? We thought of an alternative title for this class. How much trouble can Benny Friedman get himself into in one morning? I'd like to do two things. I want to share with you some thoughts on the topic, both in terms of what's going on ostensibly and what, just from my perspective, I think is really going on. I want you to know that this is not an objective fact. If you ask me, who was Abraham's son, and I say Yitzhak, that's an objective fact. And if you disagree, you're entitled to your opinion, and I'm entitled to think that you're wrong. On these issues, I envy those who know the answers. I think in life sometimes it's very healthy to struggle with questions. And it's important to know what people with whom you disagree think. It's important to respect that many of them are brilliant minds. And when a brilliant mind comes up with an alternative perspective, you have to give it its due. And I think it's also important to recognize that sometimes you have to make a choice. And then in the second half, what I'd like to do, I really want to open up the floor. Because we can't possibly, or the lawn, we can't possibly cover this topic in the hour that we have. But at least to sort of get a sense of what people's questions are. First of all, in terms of the facts, just so we're all clear on the facts, okay? We could spend an hour just discussing the history. And we could spend an hour just discussing the strategy from a military perspective, from a political perspective. But let's sort of agree on certain facts, okay? Some say that this story began in 1967. That's not true. This story began, really, you could make a case for saying this story began when Abraham first entered the land of Israel. You could make a case for saying that this story began when the Jewish people first came to the land of Israel. You see, they're disengaging already. You could make a case for saying that this story began with the story of David HaMelech, because the area that we call the Gaza Strip, historically, traditionally, was the area of the Philistines, the Plishtim. And ever since that time, when the Jews conquered the land of Israel, in different stages, a large Jewish community lived in that area. Technically speaking, because there have been some questions about this matter, the area known as the Gaza Strip is traditionally part of Eretz Israel. And it is part of, if you have a Torah perspective, biblical Israel. So that's not the question. And I guess you have two choices. You can choose to explore the historical reality, the strategic reality. Is it ours? Are we giving it back or giving it away? Should we give it away? Do we have a right to give it away? Is it halakhically permissible to give it away? If orders are given to give it away, are you allowed to follow those orders? And I'm going to save all those questions for the Q&A. If you have questions on those topics, we'll explore those. Because sometimes what happens is, we get so involved, so immersed in the facts in front of us, we lose sight of the larger picture. And I'll give you maybe by way of example. There's an interesting Gemara. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Talmudic discussion in Sanhedrin. It's on Daf Tzadi Aleph. No, Daf Tzadi Aleph on the 91st folio. It's a story that took place in the time of Alexander the Great, Alexander of Macedon. And I give credit to Rabbi Cardoza, who wrote an article on this topic, which I think is really on the mark. Okay? when Yeshua came to the land, the Talmud records that the Jews gave the Canaanites, there were seven Canaanite nations living in the land of Israel, three choices. We're coming. We believe we're coming home. We have a God that you can't see and you can't touch and you can't feel, and child sacrifice doesn't help. And this God tells us that we're meant to come home. We've been running around the desert for 40 years. We've got an impressive credit list. We've split seas. We wiped out the Egyptian Empire. We decided not to go back to Egypt. We have this manna stuff falling from heaven every day. And we happen to be 600,000 men. It's a force to be reckoned with in the ancient world. So we're coming. Now you have three choices. And Yeshua actually sent messengers, according to the Talmud, to relay these choices. You can choose to run. You can leave. We have no interest in conquering you. We simply want the land that you're dwelling in. We don't believe that we're taking this land as individuals. We believe that you lost the right to live in this land because of who you are. Because your society, and this is Rashi, the first Rashi in the Torah, because your society has sunken to a morass of immorality and idolatry, and therefore we're going to create an ethical society. Now, you can accept the seven Noahide laws, and then you can live amongst us and with us. What does that mean, to accept the seven Noahide laws? That means you have to decide that you can't kill. Murder is out. Theft is out. Idolatry is out. Child sacrifice. You have to set up a system of court. There has to be a law. There has to be an ethic in your society. You can't murder people just because you don't like what they say. If we're going to create an ethical society that the world can learn from, and you want to be our neighbors, then you have to be ethical as well. And if you accept those seven Noahide laws, you don't have to eat kosher, you don't have to start driving your donkeys on Shabbat, but if you accept those seven Noahide laws, then we can live together in peace. That's your first choice. The second choice is that you can leave. We have no interest in conquering you. If you leave, abigazunt, good for you. Or you can stay, clinging to your immoral ways from our perspective, and then we're going to have to fight. Now that's an interesting question. Why do we have to fight? You have your immoral outpost on top of that mountain, and we'll have our ethical society on top of this mountain. The Torah suggests, the Talmud supports, that doesn't work. If you live next door to a murderer, you're living in a murderous society, whether you agree with them or not. Those are the three choices. The Talmud records that there was one nation that actually chose to stay and accept the seven Noahide laws. According to some, that was the Givonim. There was one nation that chose to leave, the Girgashites. It's very interesting, by the way, according to the Gemara, the Talmud, the Girgashites went to Afriki, to Africa. And about 180 years ago, they discovered an obelisk in Namibia, and the obelisk was translated post-Rosetta Stone as saying, "We are they that fled before Yeshua, the son of Nawe, Yeshua bin Nun." Whatever you do, that is up to you. So there's a case recorded, and of course the other nations fought, and we conquered most of them. One of those nations was the Philistines, the Plishtim. There's a case recorded in the Gemara and the Talmud in Sanhedrin on the 91st folio, Tzadi Aleph, that this nation, the Girgashites, also known as Bnei Afriki, the sons of Africa, came to Alexander of Macedon after he conquered the entire known world, including Israel, in about 300 before the Common Era. And they said to him, "Their Talmud shows that we left. Their Torah says that they kicked us out. And we now feel that because we were there first, we have the right to return." See what happens when these things happen? Israel just falls by the wayside, right? Just leave it, it's okay. Right, it's not a safe Torah. At least not according to most. We want it back. Now, Alexander of Macedon, who for various reasons was actually sympathetic to the Jews, and yet was known as one of the first rulers of the world who attempted to establish a system of justice, right? He came to the Jews. He said, "Well, what do you say to this?" So the Gemara says that there was an Amaretz, there was an ignoramus, or someone who was not a tremendous Torah scholar. He was a guy like me who learned Dafyomi every day. But, you know, he wasn't big up there. So he begged the rabbis, "Let me answer the question."
Because if I represent the Jewish people and answer the question and I lose, you can always say, well, he was an ignoramus, and you'll get a second chance. But if you guys go and you lose, you're stuck. So they weighed this question, and they decided to let him go. Okay? His name was Gvia ben Psisa. And that's a whole discussion, what Psis means and how that relates to the story, but for another time. So Gvia ben Psisa goes to the Girgashites, to the Canaanites, and he says, listen. He says, it's true that the Torah says, right, that that we kicked you out of the land. But if you look earlier in the same Torah that you seem to accept because you're quoting it, it also says that Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yefet. And one of those sons, Ham, was cursed. And that son, according to the Torah, would forever be the servant of the other son, Shem. We Jews, the descendants of Shem, you are the descendants of Ham, the Canaanites, and therefore, even if you had stayed in the land, if you're accepting the Torah, you would have been our servants anyway. And everybody knows that if you have a slave, if you have a servant, then his land belongs to you. So the land would have been ours anyway. So Alexander thought this was a very sharp response. And he came back to the Canaanites and said, what do you have to say to this? They said, give us 3 days. They couldn't come up with anything. Life was good. And they disappeared back to Africa. Okay? So the Marshad, some of the commentaries, ask an interesting question. It says, why did he choose that response? That's such a strange response. Noah and the sons. Because Noah was found naked, therefore he cursed one of the sons in the way that he found. Just look anywhere in the Torah. All of the Torah, it says that God promised the land to the Jewish people. So just quote, I mean, in Bamidbar, right next to, in Numbers, right next to the verse that the Canaanites quote, is another verse that says, I give to you this land. So why do they go this cockamamie route? Says the Marshad, listen to this very well. It says, because every time God promises the land, it's a conditional promise. The land of Israel is given to us as a responsibility. We have to live up to what it means to be in the land of Israel. And if we don't live up to who we're meant to be, if we sink into the same morass of immorality, idolatry, or otherwise, then we don't deserve to be in the land. Says the Marsha, Ben Psisa doesn't quote all these other verses because in the time of Alexander, with Hellenism and immorality rampant, the Canaanites could say they've lost their right to the land just like we did. They don't deserve to be there anymore. Therefore, since we were there first, we should get it back. And if Ben Psisa had given that argument, the Canaanites would have had that response. They weren't stupid. And the Canaanites would have been right. Now, understand the implications of this. It's very challenging today in Israel. People in Israel are very angry. Some people in Israel are very excited. I think most people in Israel are in a lot of pain. And you have to be very careful with this discussion. Because I'm sharing with you an opinion. That does not mean that I have the right to say that what anyone else is feeling is wrong. That's a very dangerous thing to assume. Emotions can't be wrong. What you feel is what you feel. You know, the Talmud, when it discusses the destruction of the Second Temple, does not talk about the strategic reasons, for the most part, that we lost the Temple and Jerusalem and the land of Israel. And there are a lot of strategic reasons. Josephus writes about major strategic mistakes that were made. Should we have holed up in the cities like Gamla and Yodfat? Or should we have fought them as guerrillas in the hills? Should we have followed the example of the Maccabees who were successful? But the Talmud doesn't go there. The Talmud says, Jewish tradition says, we lost the Second Commonwealth, the land of Israel, for one very simple reason. Sinat Chinam. Let's define that for the moment as blind hatred. We lost this because of blind hatred. We didn't lose it because of them, we lost it because of us. Jewish tradition for thousands of years has always suggested that whenever things happen to us, we need to look inwards. Now this is a very dangerous thing. Because it doesn't mean that we have the right to sit in judgment, especially if some of us here are American Jews, and decide that we know what Israeli society is doing wrong. That's a very dangerous thing. First of all, it's dangerous because it's not true, because the Jewish people are one. And if we're struggling with what's wrong and what we need to fix, it's not just as a nation, or rather as citizens of the state of Israel, but of the entire Jewish people. And second of all, because I don't think that the goal is for me to figure out what everybody else is doing wrong. You know, you'll never meet a Jew who doesn't say, I don't think, that if the temple was destroyed through Sinat Chinam, through blind hatred, that we need to learn to love each other. Did you ever meet anybody who was against Jewish unity? Did you ever meet anybody who thought we shouldn't be united? You don't find that. They just have different opinions about how to get united. So although some of us discussed this on a teleconference call a couple weeks ago, I just want to repeat one idea so that we can get to where I want to go. What is Sinat Chinam? What does blind hatred mean? Okay? It's a very strange concept. You're walking down the street, and somebody sees you're Jewish. Maybe they're Jewish, maybe they're not Jewish. And they start screaming at you. And they walk over and they slap you in the face. And let's say you're not on the level to love them, so you hate them. That's not blind hatred. I mean, wouldn't you hate somebody who comes over to you and slaps you in the face every day? I can understand that. I might disagree with it. It wouldn't be blind hatred. What's blind hatred? Blind hatred is, I walk down the street, and I see you, and I hate people with white hats. I don't know why. So I walk over to you and I say, I just want you to know, I hate you. That's not normal. Maybe I walk over to you and I hate you for no reason. And you say to me, why do you hate me? I don't know. I just feel like hating you today. That's off. That's a psychosis. How could the entire Jewish people have been guilty of something like that? So the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, has a totally different perspective. He says in his introduction to the book of Genesis, the Sefer Breshit, and I want to urge you to get a copy of this. It's very easy to find. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the son-in-law of Rav Chaim Volozhin. Rav Chaim Volozhin started the yeshiva known as Volozhin. He was also the son-in-law of the Vilna Gaon. The Netziv lived in the 1800s. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. And he wrote a commentary on the Torah called Ha'emek Davar, the Valley of Words, or the Thing. It's a magnificent commentary. In his introduction to Genesis, to Breshit, which is really his introduction to the Torah, he asks a very interesting question. Why is the book of Breshit called Sefer Hayashar? Right, the book of Joshua quotes this. Halohi Ktuval Sefer Hayashar. Why is it called the book of the straight, the book of the honest? It could have been called Sefer HaChasidim. It's the book of Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the tribes. Chasidim, Tzadikim, righteous people. Sefer HaTzadikim, the book of the Tzadikim. Why is it called Sefer HaYashar? And then Tziv suggests that when God destroyed the second temple because of Sinat Chinam, it's because God cannot tolerate Dafka the Tzadik, who is not Yashar. He says, you know, in the second temple period, there were many tzaddikim. I mean, they were Tanoim from the period of the Mishnah. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was teaching Torah. Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol. If Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol and Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai couldn't teach Torah the right way, if they weren't on the level, then we should be on the level? He says, don't make a mistake. They were righteous people, tzaddikim, unbelievable giants. That generation learned Torah perhaps like no generation, at least until now. They were immersed in Torah. But they weren't Yesharim. He says, what does Sinat Chinam mean? Sinat Chinam means when I hate you just because your opinion is different from mine. If I'm an Orthodox Jew, by the way, you won't find Orthodox in the Talmud. There's no word there, Orthodox. Doesn't exist. I have yet to find, although it might be there, I have yet to find in the Gemara, in Torah Shebaal Peh, any reference to the word religious. You can find actions as being correct or incorrect. You can judge an action. The concept of a person in their totality being judged by another person is just foreign to Jewish tradition. But if I am Orthodox and I can't stand you because you're Reform, that's the definition of Sinat Chinam. If I believe that it's a tragic mistake to give away portions of the land of Israel, and you believe that we have to get those settlers out, and I detest you for that, that is the essence of Sinat Chinam according to the Netziv. That's very scary. And Sinat Chinam destroyed the Second Temple, and the Netziv goes so far as to say that when you see portions of the land of Israel destroyed, nechravot, that is a symbol that Sinat Chinam still exists in the Jewish people. So if while we're sitting here, they're plowing down synagogues, entire villages are being bulldozed to the ground, something's wrong. You know, the Baal Shem Tov has an interesting idea. The Baal Shem Tov says that when you see something in your life, don't spend so much time thinking about what that means for everybody else. First, struggle with what it means for you. If I see you speaking, if I see you desecrating Shabbat, being mechalal Shabbat, I shouldn't spend time screaming Shabbos at you. I should wonder what's missing in my Shabbat. Because maybe God is sending me a message, you need to work on your Shabbat. I'll tell you something. If the Chafetz Chaim was sitting at our breakfast table, nobody would speak Lashon Hara. Nobody would speak slander. So if I could sit at a breakfast table and somebody could speak slander, then something's wrong. I remember once, and you'll forgive me, but this story just came to mind, and anybody who knows me knows the story, but when I was in yeshiva, I got back from the army, and I went to a yeshiva called Gush, and it was over the Green Line, whatever that means, we'll get to that in a minute. And, you know, it was in an area called Gush Etzion, not far from Beit Lechem and Hebron, Arab cities, so there were patrols at night around the yeshiva, around the town. And the head of the yeshiva felt that the boys who were in the yeshiva should contribute to this. That we shouldn't let the, you know, it was part of a town called Alon Shavut. The townspeople shouldn't be guarding the yeshiva boys. The yeshiva boys should be participating in guarding. So even the Americans, when they got off the boat, would come to yeshiva, and within the first month, they would be taught about how to handle a rifle. They would be taken to a firing range. They would be taught how to shoot. And they would do guard duty as well. But they would always do guard duty with an Israeli who'd been through the army. And guys in the yeshiva always, they did kitchen duty and they did guard duty. Builds character. I've tried to share half of that equation with my children. I'm working on it. Anyway, so we were on a 2 a.m. patrol. I had already been through the army, so I was already an officer. And I had this American boy who was, you know, in yeshiva a few months. And we're talking and getting to know him. And I'm already, you know, I didn't know this then, but I'm a year away from marriage. I'm studying for the rabbinate, smicha. I was already giving shiurim classes in the yeshiva. And we're walking along, it's 2:30 in the morning, he starts telling me a joke. And about 20 seconds into the joke, I realize he's telling me a dirty joke. I couldn't believe it. I'm in yeshiva, I'm a smicha student, and this yeshiva boy is telling me a dirty joke? And I was about to wean him. What's the matter with you? Where are you? And then I thought, you know, if I do that and I really embarrass him, I have to do patrols for another hour and a half. So it's going to be uncomfortable. I was never a big believer in giving mussar and telling people off, you know. So I just let it slide and started thinking about it. And while I'm walking there thinking about it, I'm thinking, you know, if this guy was walking with the Viren Lichtenstein, the Rosh Yeshiva, this guy wouldn't have told him a dirty joke. So he must think that I'm the kind of guy who likes a dirty joke. So the joke's on me. Because I should become the kind of person that nobody could ever imagine would want to hear a dirty joke. That's a challenge. So if I see somebody doing something, there's a message for me. 2 years ago, Arik Sharon, and isn't it interesting? I mean, if we would have sat here on this lawn 10 years ago, and we would have thought about who would be the politician that would actually give away portions of itself, particularly Aza, I would venture to say that the last politician on that list would have been Arik Sharon. Arik Sharon in the 70s is the one who created the Gaza Strip. He was the one who brought security back. He was the one who said there's no difference between the settlers of Gush Katif and the settlers of Tel Aviv. So you have to sort of take a step back and wonder, not by the way that I'm justifying Arik's policies, I have my issues with them, but it's almost like God is sending a message. Like the joke's on us, something's going on. And the word in Israel that has been bandied about, that was used, that was chosen for this particular operation, was called the Hitnatkut, which we translate as the disengagement. That's not exactly what Hitnatkut means. Lehitnatek, if I walk into the room, and you're on the phone, and I have an important message for you, I say, Titnatek, cut off the phone. Cut it off. To be minutak is to be cut off. Right? If I can sit in my base medrash in yeshiva, and outside in the lawn there's a big pot party, and I don't know about it, I'm minutak, I'm cut off. I wonder, and again, I paraphrase this by saying, this is just a suggestion, an opinion, something to struggle with. I don't claim to have the answers. Be nervous if anybody tells you that they know the answers. But I wonder, if maybe Hashem is giving us this hitnatkut, Because we are minutak. We have become islands. We are cut off from each other. And I include myself. You know, when I came to Israel, I went to yeshiva. Okay, so for X number of years, you're somewhat cut off. Because you're in yeshiva, you have to build yourself up. But then I went to the army, and I thought, okay, now I'm not cut off. Now I can take what I learned into yeshiva, and I can take it into the army. And then I was getting married, and I was debating where to live. And partly for economic reasons, and partly because I saw the incredible school system, and I knew what kind of neighbors I would have, we moved to a town called Efrat. And it's true, the education there is incredible, the community is incredible. But it's basically, quote-unquote, whatever that means, a somewhat religious town. And although there are secular Jews who live there, it's certainly not the majority. And if I look at my close friends and I ask them, how many of you have really close friends who define themselves as secular? People give me a blank stare. You have religious settlements, and you have irreligious settlements. You have religious neighborhoods and irreligious neighborhoods. You have, where the left, it's not accidental when people talk about the left, they talk about Tel Aviv. And when they talk about the right, they talk about Yudan Shomron. It's because we've created islands. We're cut off from each other. And what is the source of Sinat Chinam? Why do we hate each other for different opinions? It's because we don't know each other. If my brother has a vehemently different opinion, like Batsheva was saying, you know, last night, that she and her mother have a disagreement, she couldn't hate her mother. Because the opinion comes from someone that you already love. So if I can hate someone for their different opinion, it's because I don't know them. It's because I don't start from the perception that I already love them. Now, if this blind hatred is the essence of destruction in Jewish history, and if we've been struggling with this in the state of Israel for the last 50 years, is it any wonder that pieces of the land of Israel are being lost? And I want you to know, don't think that this process has stopped. You know, for most of the people here, this is sort of a theological question. For me, this is a very real question. You know, I'm struggling with my family, whether to do things in my house, and whether we're outgrowing our house and we should, you know, try to sell it and buy another one. And the question that comes up, well, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, we're going to get notices on our door in Efrat. In fact, one of the jokes was, you know, I still wear an orange band, which is a discussion in and of itself. But one of the jokes is, right, you see? Right, that's what this is. So the big joke is, what color are we going to choose for Efrat? Green, aqua. So somebody said, let's figure out what most secular Jews wear and let's choose that color. Right? It would be funny if it wasn't so tragic. And too often in life, we're so busy struggling with the symptoms that we lose sight of the cause. It's a big problem. Imagine a fellow is brought into the emergency room in the hospital. He's 290 pounds. He's the CEO of a company. He works 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. Okay? He has so much paraphernalia around his belt, the cell phone, the pager, the home cell phone, the special cell phone for the in crowd, the pocket laptop in his pocket and the bigger laptop in his briefcase. He's got so many wires coming out of his ears from the different cell phones. He's hooked up to Bluetooth. He's got a BlackBerry and a SprintBerry, right? You can't finish a conversation with him. And he wakes up in the morning with two beers and french fries. Whoops. And he goes to sleep at night with a 500-gram steak and two more beers. And they find three packs of Marlboros in his pockets. So he has a heart attack. Duh. Okay. So the doctors are going to work on the symptoms. They're going to intubate, and they're going to plastilate, and I don't know, maybe there's a doctor, what's that called, that balloon, and they put it in, and angioplasty. Yeah. All the hospitals, they love angio. Okay. And maybe they'll do open heart surgery. Well, if he gets out of the hospital, he thanks them, and he goes back to his 500-gram hamburgers and his three packs of cigarettes, what's the point? Somebody's got to sit him down and say, there's a reason this is happening to you. That's just a symptom. And if he's smart, he'll figure out that his cholesterol is through the roof. He'll go on a 1,600-calorie-a-day diet. He'll discover the true meaning of suffering, and maybe he'll change his life. So, this is a heart attack for the Jewish people. And by the way, if it isn't a heart attack, then you need to re-examine where you are in the Jewish people. Because if thousands of people can be homeless, if we can lose a portion of the land of Israel. Now, Kabbalah teaches that every part of the land of Israel represents a different part of the body. Yerushalayim is the heart. So I don't know what Gush Katif, what Aza is, but it's a part of the body. And it's interesting, when we gave away the northern Sinai, Libriot, portions of which were absolutely part of biblical Eretz Israel, I remember a picture that still breaks my heart to this day. There were Jews in the streets of Tel Aviv, and they were handing out champagne, and they were dancing in the streets, because we were giving away the Sinai, and we were going to have a peace agreement. Okay? Peace is on the horizon. And then there were Jews, and I remember this, in Kiryat Arba, in Hebron, 4,000 people came, Rav Lior was there, and tore Kriya. They ripped their clothes in pain at the loss of Jewish towns and a portion of the land of Israel. And on the news, some clever guy decided to make a point, and he split the screen. And you had Jews dancing in Tel Aviv, and Jews crying in Hebron. And I remember at the time thinking, if this is the image, something's really wrong. You know, it's kind of like amputating a leg. God forbid a person is born into the hospital. Sometimes you can't save the leg. You got to amputate a leg. But nobody has an amputation party. Even if an amputation does save a person's life. And I'm not getting into the political question of whether this is an amputation to save a person's life or whether this is a doctor who's cutting off the wrong leg. Something's wrong. Now I will give you one glimmer of hope in the midst of this picture of despair. If sinat chinam, when we hate each other, detest each other, take issue with each other, because we disagree with each other, instead of learning to love each other for our disagreements, if that's the cause of destruction, then ahavat chinam, which Rav Kook suggests will be the rebuilding of the temple, is when I love you, not only despite, but maybe even because of your different opinion. If you can come and sit in this group, and believe in something completely different from me, but we can still sit around the Shabbat table, then that makes me love you. I think that's unbelievable. And I don't have an interest in changing your opinion, because I love you for your opinion. So, and this is a dangerous line, and shouldn't be misunderstood, which is the reason why we're going to have a question and answer session in a moment. If you can see on the news an Israeli soldier or a policeman, maybe even with an earring in his ear, and he's falling on the shoulders. And I remember one particular image that really caught me. There was I won't quote names, a person who lived in I think it was in the Beit Kalim, one of the settlements in Gush Katif, long beard, and they asked him to come out of their home. And he came out of the home, and he looked at the officer who was about to evacuate him, and they were old friends. And he looks at him, and he says, "Why are you doing this to me? Don't you understand what a mistake this is?" And the officer says, "I have my orders, we need to go." And the man with the beard, who was being asked to leave his home and everything he loves dear behind, starts to cry. And the officer, who's about to forcefully remove him from his home, falls on his shoulders and cries with him. And they walk out arm in arm. Now, politically, strategically, this is a debatable issue. And there are people who will say that this was a tragic mistake because we should have fought tooth and nail. It doesn't matter for the moment where I agree or disagree. What you see, or maybe what I see, in a picture like that, despite all my challenges and all my questions about this particular issue, is pure, raw ahavat chinam. And there was a wave of ahavat chinam. I mean, I felt at the time, and I still feel, that we made a tragic mistake in all the rallies being in Kfar Darom, and in Sderot, and in the areas around Gush Katif. The rally should have been in Haifa, and in Tel Aviv. And we should have invited everyone who disagrees with us to come share a cup of coffee. And when we had orange bands, and they had blue bands, we should have put together blue and orange bands. And we should have given them out to everybody. And they shouldn't have said, Yudi megaresh Yudi, a Jew doesn't expel another Jew. They should have said, Kol Yudi ohev kol Yudi. Every Jew loves every Jew. And I still think that we can do this. And by the way, if you want to understand the root of what some of us were talking about last night, of why we're so desperate to take the Torah that we're studying here and get it out to so many people. This is the reason. Because people need to hear this. People need to learn this. People need to practice this. So that's the theological question. Israel is riding a wave. There is an enormous window of opportunity. You know, the Tzivkas HaTzadik of Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin asks a very interesting question. He says, how come we eat matzah on Pesach? Why do we eat matzah on Pesach? So who knows? Why do we eat matzah on Pesach? Why? Because we didn't have enough time to make the dough, right? Now that's true. It says, terem batzei kamalu, right? Before their dough rose. That's true. But as I was discussing with somebody one night this week, it's also ridiculous. First of all, God knows since the birth of time that the Jews are going to get out of Egypt. 600,000 Jews get out of Egypt, maybe millions of Jews. But God can't make an extra 18 minutes for the dough to rise. It's ridiculous. And by the way, even beyond that, a week before the Jews get out of Egypt, at the beginning of the 12th chapter of Exodus, even before Moshe is told to tell the Jewish people about the mitzvah of the Paschal Lamb, the Jews will take the Paschal Lamb on the 10th day of Nisan, 5 days before they get out of Egypt. So before they're even given that mitzvah, a week in advance of the Exodus, God tells Moshe, you're going to have a festival, Shivat Yamin, Tochlu Matzot, and you're going to eat matzah for 7 days. So they know they're going to eat matzah. Or at least Moshe knows they're going to eat matzah. It's what they couldn't prepare. So the Tzikas HaTzadik says, this is so deep. It says, God takes the Jewish people out at a particular moment, in a particular time, and he arranges it in such a fashion that if we would have left any later, we never would have gotten out. But any earlier, we weren't ready to go. And he creates the paradigm where there is no time for the dough to rise. Because the exodus from Egypt represents that window of opportunity that comes along every so often in life. And when a window like that opens up, you have to grab it. You know, we all have our personal Egypts. And sometimes you get an opportunity to get out of your Egypt. You get an inspiration, you get a moment. When you get such a moment, you have to grab it, because it doesn't last. On a personal level, if you had an experience like that this week, if you feel that there's some Egypt that's been blocking your soul, and all of a sudden, you got something, you got something, and you realize there's something you could do, don't wait. Grab that opportunity, whatever it is, whether it's an opportunity to change your relationships, whether it's an opportunity to change the way you study, or who you are, grab it, because it's all too fleeting. That is true not only for an individual, that's true for the Jewish people. We have a window. We've been stuck in a Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim, according to the Maharal, comes to the word Mitzarim, the narrow places. When Jews can't get along with other Jews, we're stuck in a narrow place. We can break free of that narrowness with all the pain that leaving Gush Katif has, will continue to, and should entail. And we can transform this event, at the very least, into something that builds the Jewish people. Because the problem in the Middle East has never been the Arabs. The problem has always been the Jews. So that's perception one on this topic. And I wanted to share that with you. You know, somebody came over to me afterwards yesterday and asked me, you know, why am I still wearing this orange band? And to be honest, I guess part of it is just personal. I can't bring myself to take it off. Where's Batsheva? Is Batsheva here? I want you to know that when I was in high school, I wore an armband from Mark Dimshitz. But I never got to meet him. Same guy. And I had the same reaction to the name, and that's why I hid it under my sleeve. But only about a week after getting one of these orange armbands, and the reason I wear this armband is not because of politically I'm for or against, it's because I don't want a day to go by where I'm not at least thinking about these people who are going through what they're going through, having never done anything wrong. Whatever you say on this topic, nobody, not on the left or the right, is claiming that the Jews living in the Gush Katif Strip did anything wrong. They were encouraged by left-wing governments to go live in these areas. They settled in areas that were not settled by Arabs. They built magnificent businesses, magnificent homes. They covered, by the way, the gamut of politics, left and right, interestingly enough. Some of them had magnificent homes on the beach. Incredible. And I don't want a day to go by where I don't think about them. So that's just my way of thinking about them. But I am bothered by the line on the band. It says, Yudi lo megaresh Yudi. which means a Jew doesn't expel a Jew. First of all, I don't know that that's true. We live in the Jewish state of Israel, and there can be instances where a Jew breaks the law. Maybe he's squatting on my home, and he's not paying his rent, and I have a right to go to the law and to ask the law to expel a Jew from a home. So I don't know that that's true, A. B, I'm not sure that you would call this Gerush. Gerush was Gerush Sfarad. We were expelled from Spain. We were told to leave. They didn't want anything to do with us. They hated us, and they kicked us out. With all the disagreements and the perception, by the way, which I'm sure we'll get into once you start to ask your questions, that we've made a tragic mistake here on many different levels, I still don't think it's fair to call this an expulsion. Because with all the problems, I don't think the state of Israel is expelling these Jews. They're inviting them to join them. In fact, they'd be much happier if these people came to live in Tel Aviv than if they go to Yehuda Shomron over the Green Line. So this is a legitimately debatable issue. And I'll tell you two last things on the current situation and the strategic questions, and then we'll open up the floor. First, you know, the Arabs understand something that we don't. They're very good at the use of words. They're very good at poetic license. Maybe we understand the power of words, and therefore we're much more careful about the words we use. I think that we made a terrible error in the last year, year and a half. And a lot of people are taking to task those that they perceive as being the leadership of this campaign. I think that we chose emotional slogans instead of strategic issues. I think that that there are two problems here. The first, which relates to what we just spoke about. You know, I have to ask myself, why would I cry bitter tears at the thought of leaving a piece of land? Because I think that that land is special. Because I think that land is something we've dreamed of for 2,000 years. Because I think that land historically belongs to us. Because I think that there's a part of us that we can never become if we're not connected to that land. So why is it that half the population of the country, and you can debate the statistics, even if it's 40%, not only has no idea what I'm talking about, but could care less? That's a failure. And that failure is not strategic, and it's not political, it's educational. If there is a population of Jews in the land of Israel who had the opportunity to be a bridge to create Ahavat Chinam, it's particularly those Jews, like me, who live in the modern world, who serve in the Israeli army on the one hand, but who learn in yeshiva and love Torah and relate to mitzvot on the other. The ultra-Orthodox world can talk to us, and the secular world can talk to us. And instead of becoming a bridge, instead of spending time getting to know the secular population, whatever the word secular means, because I don't think such a thing really exists in Israel, instead of getting to know that population, instead of being an educational vehicle, instead of being able to share with them why we love this land so much, we became islands. We focused on building the land, and we lost touch with educating the people. And I want you to know, on a certain level, we deserve what we got. And Rabbi Aaron and I were talking about this. You know, we feel that this window, there are a lot of Jews right now who are struggling with this question on both sides of the corner. There was a certain nobility that many Jews who were forced to leave their homes displayed that caught the secular world, some of them, by surprise, and has at least some people asking, so who are these people? And why are they so connected? And I hope that this larger community of Jews that can serve as a bridge begins to do just that. That's the first. The second is a purely strategic discussion. I think the reason that we made a mistake, or those who made these decisions made a mistake, in the way this, you want to call it a battle, this campaign was fought, is because we appeal to people's emotions. You can't appeal to people's emotions if they emotionally don't understand what you're talking about. You know? We didn't try to do a Havdalah with you when you got off the bus on Thursday, because you would have looked at us like we're wacko. We spent the Shabbat together, and then we thought, okay, maybe now you trust us enough to be willing. I mean, if I went to one of your synagogues, I don't know, Young Israel of Woodmere, and I spoke to the rabbi, I said, listen, I'm coming in Saturday night, let's do a 3-hour Havdalah. He'd say, I was out of my rocker. And you'd be right. And I've never tried that in the shul, because I think I'd get stoned. And I don't mean in a different way. But once you develop a relationship and a trust, you can go there. So that whole tack makes no sense to a population that doesn't understand it. You know what the secular population in Israel understands? They understand strategy, because they've all been in the army. And that was a terrible mistake that we made. Strategically, this makes no sense. Even Yossi Beilin initially was vehemently opposed to this plan because he felt that it's a tactical error. to give something without getting something in return. And we learned this lesson already. I mean, we all saw what happened in Lebanon. We basically did a unilateral pull out of Lebanon. And the issue in Lebanon in 2000, I mean, we had been in Lebanon almost 20 years, and I spent some time serving in Lebanon, and I gather there's someone else here who also spent some time. We haven't had a chance to talk yet. So I would be willing to bet that you agree with me on this. None of us loved being in Lebanon. And we don't want to be in Lebanon, and we didn't want to stay in Lebanon, but it was time to pull out of Lebanon. The problem with pulling out of Lebanon wasn't getting out of Lebanon. I have no problem leaving Lebanon. The problem was we did it in such a way that gave completely the wrong message. It wasn't the pull out, it was a retreat. So people will say, well, but look at Lebanon now. It's true 3 months later, three soldiers were kidnapped. It's true that initially there were a lot of katyushot. But things have calmed down, and it's fair to say, given the rate of casualties of Israeli soldiers in Lebanon, you could say that there was a net gain. But that's not true. Because the Arabs living in Israel, who some call Palestinians, they learned a very important lesson from this. They learned that terror works. That's exactly why the fighting broke out in 2000. And the challenge is, are we making the same mistake now?
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.